So how do you feel about the term dive bar?
It doesn't bother me at all. That's good.
This is Steve. He's the bartender at an old Irish bar in Somerville, Mass. Called Sligo Pub. And Steve's been there for 6 years, but the bar's been there a lot longer.
There's a guy that comes in here. He's 78. He was shining shoes when he was 8 years old in here. So this bar, it's been here for 70 years at least.
And when you switched jobs and you came here, what drew you to this place?
Because I don't have to make martinis.
Today on The Sporkful, ahead of St. Patrick's Day, we're going to ask, what makes a great bar and what makes a great bartender? I went to Sligo Pub to find the answer to that first question, and I ended up finding so much more. I just can't wait for you to hear the people that I met there. And then later in the show, I'm going to have a drink with a priest. But not just any priest. This one's got a special title.
The chaplain to the D.C. Craft Cocktail Bartenders Guild.
And I was said, that a vacancy? The previous chaplain had left?
I think I was the inaugural chaplain. And I said, well, what would my duties be? He said, well, we didn't really think about that, but I guess you'd just have to keep coming to our bars and eating and drinking, but we'll charge you less.
Father Bill Daly is going to make me a drink called the Gaelic Flip, and he'll explain what a great priest and a great bartender have in common. That's coming up. Stick around. From WNYC Studios, this is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman. Each week on our show, we obsess about food to learn more about people. And before I take you to Sligo Pub, I got to set this place up for you a little bit. First, Sligo is a county in Ireland, County Sligo. That's where that word comes from. Now, it's in Davis Square, Somerville, Massachusetts, just on the outskirts of Boston. Davis Square, kind of an old Irish-Italian neighborhood that has gentrified somewhat in recent years, but not completely. And it's right near Tufts University, where I went to college. And for 4 years, I was at Tufts, and when I had my fake ID and when I had my real ID, I went to all the cheesy college kid bars in Davis Square. I never set foot in the Sligo. The Sligo was known as the townie bar. And the perception was that someone like me was not welcome there. After I graduated, I still lived nearby. A couple friends of mine started hanging out at the Sligo. And they were like, you've got to come to this bar. Like, it is the greatest place. Like, it's so warm and friendly and full of every kind of character you could imagine. And oh, by the way, the drinks cost half as much as what they cost at the bar down the block. And I started hanging out there and I fell in love with Sligo Pub. Fast forward to today. I went into Sligo Pub just recently and the place hasn't changed a bit. Still the sort of lived-in, no-frills feel. And I told the bartender why I was there, and he sort of made this announcement to the five or six regulars. This is a Monday afternoon, five or six regulars sitting at the bar. Anyone want to talk to this guy on the radio? One of the guys sitting at the bar, without saying a word, picks up his pack of cigarettes and turns, leaving half a drink on the bar, turns and walks right out the door. And does not say a word and does not come back, okay? There is a certain crustiness to Sligo Pub. In a way, it's a lot like New Englanders. It's kind of crusty on the outside, but once you get past the crust, there's a very soft, warm, and fuzzy interior. And so that guy left, and I could tell that this was going to be a bit of a tough nut to crack to get these regulars to talk to me, so I didn't pull out the mic right away, ordered a beer, sat with the guys, we watched some Family Feud together, chatted. Eventually, I decided it was time to start recording. And since I fell in love with Sligo, the term dive bar has gained this sort of hipster cachet. And I was really curious because nowadays that's probably how you would describe Sligo. So I started off talking to one of the regulars named Mike, and I asked him how he feels about that label.
I mean, I guess I equate dive bar to a neighborhood bar, you know, where you can come without any airs. You know, you can hear something on the jukebox. You don't have to refinance to have a drink.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting that term dive bar has become this sort of like newfangled. It has this sort of like weird hipster cachet, but I feel like it's kind of, I can understand how it could be perceived as sort of insulting.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you can try too hard in a lot of things in life, you know. Well, you try too hard to be a dive bar, you know, if a natural bar may be a dive bar, you know, or, you know, you try and be cool, chic, and, you know, dark and funky, or you can just be yourself, whether it's life or a bar. we're here in Davis Square at the Sligo, and this it is what it is. Either you like it or you don't, and they don't apologize for it.
What does this bar mean to you now?
It's you know, it's a comfortable shoe that, you know, you come in and you put it on, and if you want to chit-chat or whatever and talk about, you know, did you see the debate last night? Did you see the Patriots last night or whatever? You can do that. It's a place that I have a certain comfort level to, I can do what I want and, you know, be left alone in doing it.
I said goodbye to Mike and made my way down the bar to a guy named Corky. He's a carpenter from Ireland.
I'm going to say I moved to this country 15 years ago. I've been coming here about 13, 14 years. It used to be great years ago, and Monday mornings especially, when people didn't go to work, and there'd be a ton of Irish in here. but it was good times. Oh, it was good times.
What makes these bars special?
It's definitely the characters in the bar. Exactly. It has to. Different people, like, but genuine, honest people. That's what I like about coming here. I could leave $100 on this counter and walk out the door and come back a half an hour later, it'll be still here. You know what I mean?
How do you feel about the term dive bar?
I just think it's just somebody makes up this name and it's to give it a reward. I don't class it as a dive bar. To me, it's just a bar. It's like a home bar to me. That's what it is. It's home. It's home.
Remember at the start of this show, Steve the bartender mentioned an older guy who comes in all the time who shines shoes at the Sligo as a boy? Well, when I turn around, he was sitting right next to me. His name is George.
I was born here in Somerville.
Wow.
So I came in and started shoe shining about 6-7 years old. Mrs. Conley owned it. Mr. and Mrs. Conley owned it at the time.
And you came in here to shine shoes to make some money?
Yeah.
When you were 6 or 7 years old?
Yeah.
And may I ask how long ago that was?
No, you can't.
Steve estimated that it was about 70 years ago. Can we go with that rough estimate?
Well, it may be close.
Okay.
Close. I'm not going to say anything. I usually try to keep my age to myself, you know.
Right.
My age.
So you've been coming to this bar for roughly 70 years.
Yeah.
What do you love about it?
Oh, I've been coming here a long time. I like the people. Mrs. Connolly was very, very nice. And when you're a young African-American kid, a little boy and everything, people might want to play it, not attack you, but they, you know. And she made me feel very, very protective. She was very protective to me. And she would say, like, don't mess with him, don't rub his head, anything, just pay him his money and give him a tip. When she died, I went to her funeral over in St. John's Church, and her husband was there, and he told me, my wife liked you, and she was the nicest lady. I was like her grandchild, and that's the way things were.
I'm sure that especially many decades ago, there were, you know, times that being an African-American young man was not so easy.
Well,
anywhere in the country, certainly here.
When I graduated Somerville High, there were 697 kids there. Graduating my senior class, and 693 were white. There was 4 minorities, 1 girl and 3 guys. And that's the way things were.
You know, it's interesting because there is like a stereotype that there's sort of like traditionally Boston Irish community not exactly getting along with African Americans. I think it's pretty great that...
I don't remember having any problems like that in Somerville. And I got along. We got along. Maybe because it was a very small minority. Very, very small. So there was no challenge to things that were going on.
They didn't feel threatened.
No, not one bit.
George, you've been walking in the front door of this bar for 70 years. What do you feel like now when you walk in the door?
I don't feel any difference. The same bar, you know, I know all the people in here.
But what's the feeling that you get?
Hey, I came in for a drink. That's it.
Well, let's get your drink. What are you drinking, George?
I am drinking wine.
Okay. Steve, can we get a drink for George here?
You're going to buy it, then.
Yeah, I'm buying you a drink, George.
All right, then I will take scotch.
Give the man a scotch.
I drink scotch in here. They know it.
Well, cheers to Mrs. Connolly. That's what I say.
Yep, cheers to her. She's a fine lady.
Thanks to George, Corky, Mike, Steve the bartender, and all the guys at Sligo Pub in Somerville, Mass. It felt really good to be back there. Kind of like Mike said, like slipping on an old shoe. Coming up, we'll turn from what makes a great bar to what makes a great bartender and a great drink. I'll meet up with Father Bill Daly. He's a priest, a Notre Dame law professor, and an expert mixologist. He'll mix me a drink and tell me about the time that a nun gave him his first taste of bourbon. I'll tell him about the time they wouldn't let me into the Vatican. Stick around. Welcome back to The Sporkful from WNYC Studios. I'm Dan Pashman. In a few weeks, we're going to be launching a series here on the show all about food and race and culture. It's sort of going to be about how we can understand our perception of culture and race through food, by talking about food. I'm hopeful that it's going to be the kind of conversation you just don't hear very often, and I'm really excited for you to get a chance to hear it. There's also going to be a live show as part of this, and I'll have the ticket info on that in just a minute. But first, here's a little taste of what we're working on.
People will ask, like, so, you know, where are you from? Where are your parents from? And I'll tell them I was born in Korea. And they'll say, so, do you eat kimchi? Do you eat kimchi every day? Is your family, when you have Thanksgiving, do you just have a giant 20-pound kimchi?
I just remember one kid coming over and kind of coughing because there had been, like, chilies fried in oil right before. And I think those types of cues kind of made me think, like, oh, I'm different.
I grew up always knowing that when you're around white people and other folks don't eat fried chicken and watermelon, because there was a shame associated with those foods.
How many times would we have to go out to eat together before you'd eat, have fried chicken with me?
A lot. A lot of times that I would have to curse and, like, get drunk.
So that's a quick preview of what we got in store. And like I said, there's a live show Thursday, March 24th, just a couple weeks from now, at WNYC's Green Performance Space in New York. We'll have actress Rosie Perez there, artist Ashok Kondabolu, a.k.a. Dap of Chillin' Island, formerly of Das Racist, will be there. And I want you to be there. So get your tickets right now at sporkful.com/live. Now back to our St. Patrick's Day show, or at least it's loosely a St. Patrick's Day show. So it's only fitting that the second half also take place in a bar, the Churchill in New York. Now, the Churchill is an English pub, not an Irish one. More on that later. It's owned by an Englishman named Scott and his wife, Sinead, who is Irish. Sinead's lived in the U.S. for 22 years, but I could tell when I talked to her, she still misses home. When you walk into a pub in the U.S. that claims to be an Irish pub, what are some of the things, the little things that tip you off as to whether it's a good Irish pub or some sort of like cheesy tourist bar?
The amount of plastic, I suppose, but
plastic,
and the TVs everywhere. We don't do that at home. I don't know. It's just a little quieter and darker, and it's more about chat and beer and meeting people, and I don't know, it's just a different vibe. It's the vibe, maybe.
Right. I was thinking one of the rules that I might look at is the ratio of chairs per square foot. You know, because like you said, like a good Irish pub, people are sitting down
they're sitting and talking.
When I walk into a bar that claims to be an Irish pub, but it's got like, you know, 500 square feet of empty space because they just want like a dance floor.
You know, I never thought about that.
Right?
Yeah. But
is
it's
that
true.
A good rule?
Yeah. Because we would have a lot of the soft seating and the little banquettes, you
exactly.
know.
Exactly.
The odd painting on the wall or lots of wood. They're just very simple. They're very simple.
But warm.
Very warm. And sometimes in some of the older pubs in town, there were little fireplaces, but you don't see them so much anymore.
Right. Fireplace and carpeting, that's another.
Oh, carpets. Oh, my God. There were those carpets.
Right.
And some of them were just so awful. Oh, my God. No, you don't see that here, right?
Yeah.
No, unless hotel lounges. No.
That's right.
No.
So when it's St. Patrick's Day in the U.S., a lot of people who aren't Irish act the way they think Irish people act.
Yeah. At home, people used to go to Mass.
On St. Patrick's Day?
On St. Patrick's Day. You'd get the shamrock, the fresh shamrock from the plant in the hallway. You go to Mass, and there might be the odd parade in town or something like that. But these were not drinking days. You know, they weren't. I don't actually think the pubs in Ireland were open on St. Patrick's Day until recent years. You know, it was a very, very different thing. Now things have changed, and you know, there are larger parades, and it's more festive and
But as an immigrant to the U.S., do you feel like, I mean, on one hand, St. Patrick's Day has become kind of gross and a sort of bastardization of Irish culture. But on the other hand, there is a through line of it that's like an Irish Pride Day parade. Like, it's your day in America.
I was really taken by it when I first came here. I think I used to be very emotional about it almost, that all of these people were just walking up Fifth Avenue and they were all Irish or claimed to be Irish, and it was kind of phenomenal.
So where would you rather celebrate St. Patrick's Day?
I would always rather be in Ireland, of course. But there is a little bit of sentimental pride standing in New York on St. Patrick's Day and feeling very good about being Irish.
I was joined at the Churchill by Father Bill Daly. He's a Catholic priest, a law professor at Notre Dame, and a guy known to make a mean cocktail. In fact, the Washington, D.C. Craft Cocktail Bartenders Guild made him their official chaplain. They created the role just for him. Father Bill makes me a drink called a Gaelic Flip.
I like to have the upper hand in interviews, and so the smartest way to do that is to get the interviewer soused. So let's see.
Don't worry, he made one for himself too. The Gaelic Flip is made with Irish whiskey, sweet vermouth, allspice liqueur, and...
And then we need a couple of whole eggs.
I love a drink with a whole egg in it. Shake it, add ice, give it another shake. Strain it into a glass, add a sprinkle of fresh nutmeg on top.
Fresh nutmeg.
And you're in business.
Give that a try.
All right, well, cheers.
Cheers.
Oh, it's really nice. What I like about this is I feel like it's a really good late winter, early spring, around St. Patrick's Day kind of drink, because it'll warm you up a little. If you got like a chilly, rainy St. Patrick's Day, it'll warm you up. But it's also kind of refreshing.
Yes.
So, Father, the first thing we got to get out there for people who, because some people, I told them I was going to come tape this with you, and they were like, wait, priests can drink?
They're obviously not Catholics.
Right. Forgive some of the ignorant setup here, but for people who don't know, priests can drink?
Priests can drink. It is the case that in the Gospel of John, the very first public miracle of Jesus is the famed wedding at Cana, where he, of course, turns water into wine. It's hard for me to understand how that could be a central first public miracle, and I'm not supposed to drink as a Christian. So we tend to take the idea that virtue is found in the mean, and obviously alcohol is a danger and a toxin and has to be respected like many aspects of human life, but can be enjoyed in moderation.
Can nuns drink?
They can. In fact, I was when I was in the seminary, the first time I had Maker's Mark was with a wonderful Sister Lourdes Sheehan. Other than water and the precious blood at Mass, the only thing I ever saw Sister Lourdes drink was Maker's Mark. great woman from Savannah.
Let's delve into the priesthood a little bit more.
Sure.
How did you come to want to be a priest?
Arriving at the priesthood is like figuring out, I suppose, how you know whom you want to marry. And I hope that that's not a particularly completely logical answer for most people. Hopefully you say, this is the moment when my heart was captured, and there's some mystery to that.
Right.
My family were devout Catholics, and we always had the priests over for dinner, so I had an uncle who was a priest. He served in the missions in Central America, so I thought highly of priests, but it was only when I saw how it was lived at Notre Dame that I thought it might be something that I was called to.
What are some of the similarities between what drew you to the priesthood and what drew you to mixology?
What is it that brings a person into church? Well, they've just had a baby, so we have a baptism to solemnize, to celebrate, to bring everyone together to say, here's this new life. They've just lost a friend. Some people's only experience of church this year might be that a friend or two has died and they go to the funeral. They've come to a town and don't really know how to build community, and so the same idea that a priest has to meet a person where they are, assess what is their need, why have they come to me today? Is it joyous? Is it anxious? Is it sorrow? So a bartender has to orchestrate, as a priest does, this community of people, some of whom are celebrating, some of whom may need a little reproving, some of whom need encouragement.
It's interesting. I'm thinking about sort of like the life of a priest out there in the world. And I mean, obviously, you seem like a guy who is, you know, very intelligent and intellectually curious. And so you're probably wiser than the average person anyway. But I would think, like, is it sometimes like people come to you and they expect you to have wisdom. And I'm sure in some ways you do. But like, is that a hard pressure sometimes to feel like you're always expected to have the answer?
You know, it's true sometimes that people think what I have to offer is wisdom. Often the wisdom that I have is the wisdom to just be silent. And that would be, again, another characteristic of overlap with bartenders, right? Sometimes you just need to go tell your bartender what's happened that day. You wouldn't believe what I went through at work today. And a really good bartender doesn't have to tell you how to fix the boss or fix the colleague, but you're glad they're there. They sympathize. They might give a knowing grunt. You know, maybe they've had a similar frustrating experience at work. Very often, the wisdom that the priest offers is really more of the silence that you need to get something off of your chest, to process it yourself, but with a person you can trust who doesn't have a dog in the fight. People can trust when they come to me, as I hope they can trust talking to their bartender, that what they're saying is going to be held in confidence and received with compassion.
You tweeted a photo recently of two cocktails at a bar in Chicago, and you wrote, I'm not going to pronounce this correctly, but Stat Crux Dum Volvitur Orbis.
That
what does that mean?
That is the motto of the Carthusian Order. The Carthusian Order of Monks from Chartreuse, France. They were founded in 1085 by St. Bruno. And since the early 18th century, they've been producing green chartreuse. And on every bottle of green chartreuse, there's a cross on an orb, a globe, which is their insignia. The motto, Stat Crux, the cross stands, Dum Volvitur Orbis, while the globe turns. It's about the stability of the faith and of the cross amidst all that changes in the world, that brings us anxiety, that makes us, that knocks us off our path.
But I'm curious, like with green chartreuse and the monks, there's the Belgian Trappist monks. Mm-hmm. What do you think it is? There is this amazing history of religious figures for hundreds of years creating these amazing alcoholic concoctions.
Historically, priests were, you know, for many centuries, the most educated person in the village or in the room, just by dint of they were the only person with such professional training or education. They were also the apothecary in town. Now, medicine was terrible in those days, and green chartreuse seemed to be as good a bet as anything to make you well. What the heck? If your cousin was sick, take him to the monk. He'll give him some green chartreuse. At least he'll feel better on some dimension.
Can I tell you the story about the time that I went to the Vatican?
Sure.
So I was there. I was a college kid, you know, backpacking around Europe, and of course I wanted to see the Vatican. So I go to St. Peter's Cathedral. So it's an amazing sight. And I go into the church to see it, and they wouldn't let me in because I was wearing shorts. I found it somewhat disappointing. After I was denied entry to the church, I went over to the Sistine Chapel. And I don't know if it's still there, but there was a suggestion box at the Sistine Chapel. So I, being young and full of hubris, couldn't resist putting a note in the suggestion box, and I wrote something to the effect of, I thought God loves everybody. If so, why can't I get into the holiest Catholic church based on what I'm wearing? I should certainly hope that St. Peter doesn't have any address code at the gates of heaven, which may have been an obnoxious thing to say, but I
certainly understand that sentiment, but there is another side which says, if you know you're going to a very special place, why wouldn't you expect to, you wouldn't go to dinner at Danielle, right, with cutoff shorts, but it might have been an 80-degree day in Rome, and I think they've relaxed that rule a little bit. And if not, if you left your suggestion with Pope Francis, my goodness, he would probably tweet it and buy you Peroni.
Well, I put the suggestion in the suggestion box, and I went back outside, and a bird pooped on me. So,
that,
I don't know
this
if...
This must have been during the pontificate of Pope Benedict. You know? he was. I love Pope Benedict. That's merely a joke.
That's Father William Daly. A couple more notes on green chartreuse. That's the liqueur invented by those French monks that he referenced. First fun trivia, we get the shade of green that we call chartreuse from the drink green chartreuse. Okay, that's how old this drink is. It was a drink before it was a color. As far as how it tastes, like it's very strong but also sweet, very herbal, sort of like, it smells like a pine tree. And I mean that as a compliment because I happen to be on a huge green chartreuse kick right now. Ever since I was on this podcast called Let's Drink About It, they made me a cocktail called a Lawn Dart that has green chartreuse, gin, tequila, lime juice, agave syrup, and, wait for it, muddled bell peppers. It is amazing. It's strong and sweet, but beyond that, I can't really describe it to you because it doesn't taste like anything else you ever tasted in your life. So just go and make one for yourself. Also, it's green, so it's perfect for St. Patrick's Day. We'll post the recipes for the Lawn Dart and for Father Bill's Gaelic Flip at Sporkful.com. My thanks to Sinead and Scott and everyone at Churchill's. The reason why we did this St. Patrick's-themed interview at an English pub was that we needed a place where they would let Father Bill get behind the bar and actually make some drinks. Mrs. Sporkful and Sinead are old friends. Sinead was nice enough to make it happen. And I gotta say, the fish and chips at Churchill's, outstanding. The fries, or chips, alone, I mean, those are worth a visit. They might be in my top five fries in my life. And I don't say that lightly. Okay, so check out Churchill's. Remember, we got a big live event coming up as part of our forthcoming series, Is This Food Racist? The event is Thursday, March 24th at the Green Space in Manhattan with guest Rosie Perez. Yes, the Rosie Perez, actress Rosie Perez, live on stage. Plus artist Ashok Kondabolu, formerly of Das Racist. Get your tickets now at sporkful.com/live. This show is a production of WNYC Studios and The Sporkful. It's produced by Ann Sani and me. We get music help from Black Label Music. Special thanks to Joanna Solitaroff and Paula Schumann. And hey, special thanks, production credit for Mrs. Sporkful, who helped make the Churchill happen. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman.
And I'm Eric Stauffer from Indianapolis, Indiana, reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.